The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast by Fresh FM, with the assistance from New Zealand On Air.
This is Tasman Report. I'm John Bullock. Coming up on the show, we talk about the year-to-date for council, summer, did we get enough rain, and composting can mean thriving gardens and saving money. Find out how coming up. Underlining the first 5 months of this year has been a sense of transition with much talk about AI, a cautious economy, the war in the Middle East, and climate and weather still shaping up our national mood. But there's been some good news with the upswing in tourism, dairy and wool prices, and the headlines from our sporting champions, well, they've been pretty good. So how did the business of Tasman District Council fare? For that story, we're joined by Chief Executive Officer Leonie Ray. One of the things that you said about doing in 26 came out of 25.
Yeah.
Is looking at how you could streamline the structure, make the meetings far more effective. Yeah. So you're quarter into this year, 26. You know, how do you feel that's gone?
Oh, look, it was a bit of a bumpy start because we had we changed the meeting structures. The reason for that was when we looked at the reports over the last triennium, about 80% of them were information reports, and they were, and peppered in between them the odd decision report, and there was some wariness going on in terms of they have so much information that they would by the time we got the decision reports it was almost overwhelming. So what we've done is we've actually separated those out, and now it's more focused on decisions. So standing committees are about decisions, and we want to get decisions made, and we want to make sure that they're fresh when they do them. Making decisions 3 in the afternoon when they've sat in the chamber all day, well, no one does well.
So a part of that, a key to that, has been this information forum. And I sit on them regularly, and I'd say anyone who looks at the council YouTube channel, do this, because you hear so much. It's a really good considered discussion about all sorts of technical things, and also some of the things we're doing in social infrastructure.
Yeah, I think it's really important that we have a channel for information to go out to the public and also to inform elected members. So this isn't just a forum for elected members, this is for everyone. And you're right, I think people should start having a look at some of those. You can dive in and out. We've got some really good technology now that you can fast forward to certain subjects, etc. The staff go to the information forum so that sometimes it's to inform a future decision, sometimes it's just an update. But then we also get quite technical. We start talking about hydrology and the dynamics of our rivers, and it's actually some really interesting information. And it's been well received. In fact, we've got so much information that, you know, I am going to suggest perhaps having it 4 weekly rather than 6 weekly, because otherwise it's a full day and it's massive. Yeah.
Well, out of the last couple of months, we've spun out the annual plan. Mm-hmm. What do you see as some of the key things we needed to get over the line, so to speak?
Well, people don't understand, with an annual plan, it's generally what you do is already set in the long-term plan. So that's why long-term planning is important. So year three, the long-term plan is essentially the annual plan I'm consulting on right now. The challenges we had with this annual plan was that we had a storm event, and we've got a significant amount of borrowing we have to cover, because we get some money from insurance and we get some money from the government, but it doesn't cover it all. And most of the work is in our rivers, and that's costly. So there's a lot of repair to our infrastructure that needs to happen, and also some of our roading. Our underground assets didn't get damaged as much, which was a saving really for us. So that meant that we had to, how are we going to pay for that? So we look at intergenerational equity. We look at, okay, so do we pay that off over 5 years, 10 years? Because debt has to be paid off. Mm. And that was a council decision. They have to make these decisions and saying, is this a 5-year thing, a 10-year thing? Secondly, these storms seem to be happening more regularly. Mm. The last big one was in 2022. We didn't get hit quite so bad. Nelson got hit worse. So what happens in 5 years? In that 5 years, we get another event. So we have to have a better strategy about how we manage this. And some of that might be we start building a resilience fund so that we've got money to cover some of these things. The other thing we had a really good look at was all our insurance and how that was all set up. We managed to save close to $1 million on our insurance premiums just by being smarter we've got a we've had a staff member who used to be an underwriter. So go forth, go out there and get us a better deal. And they so people don't see that all these savings have been happening. The other thing about this long-term plan as well is that we're quite behind on our renewals for water. And there's lots of reasons for that. I spoke last week about decisions that were made during COVID, 0% rate rises, then 1% and 2%. They were pushing renewals out into the future. We talk about intergenerational equity. So is it fair for the people today to be paying for something that perhaps should have been paid for back then? And once you get behind in renewals, it's very hard to catch up. So 5.3% of the increase is actually to try and to cover our renewals program. And the more you push them out, the more costly they are to repair. So those are the two big factors that have meant that our rates increase is 5.3 plus for the water, 2.3 for our storm event, and 2.3 is actually the rest of the business. That's everything else we do. We're a unitary. So actually, we're within the rates cap.
Another good thing, another good piece of news about the annual plan was, in fact, the feedback that came in.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because it can be quite divisive when you start talking about facilities. So people think that, oh, well, I don't use it, why should I pay? But I always look at there's a greater good. What sort of community do we want? Mm. You know, when someone says to me, well, I don't use the library, why should I pay for that? Well, do you use the prison service? Because you pay for that in your taxes. Because we want a society that we've got free healthcare, we've got, we're putting money into the economy, we've got good infrastructure. It's for the greater good of our country. We want the greater good for our communities. And quite often, facilities are the things that bring community together.
Well, on that line, let's talk about Plan Change 81 that soon will be notified. This is a milestone. We are going to get some good stuff out of this.
Yes, Plan Change 81. So for those who don't understand, Plan Change 81 was put on hold when the government came out with the RMA changes. And it's a growth plan. The minister has come to us and said we can continue with it, which is good. It is a milestone. It allows for growth, it allows for intensification as well as greenfield growth. We've got to plan for the future. And quite often we have to put the infrastructure in ahead of growth. Yeah. But if we don't plan for it and we don't put it in, then developers won't come. And we need more housing. And we need to get housing more affordable. And that's a supply and demand. So the more supply we have, the less demand there is, the lower the cost. So it's for the future. This is very future focused, and that's what the councils do. We've got to look at 30, 50, 100 years. You know, what sort of region do we want to be? Where do we want people to be? How do we look after our environment? What's the best place for infrastructure? Then we plan our public transport around those infrastructure. It's quite holistic, and so no, it's exciting. Yes.
Well, another thing that got us all excited in the last couple of weeks, local government reform. As such, in this new tranche of government policy and direction, we're not included in that. And I think this is a point we have to be quite clear about, isn't it? No amalgamation here. This is not what this is about.
No, this is about essentially dismantling our regional function, the regional function. So across New Zealand, we've got regional councils, and they do things like the rivers, the stormwater, they do biodiversity, etc. The government are looking to bring those into one council, so there's not two lots of decision making. So if you're in Canterbury, for example, which I'm from, you'd vote for the elected members there, and you'd vote for the elected members of your city council. And quite often they could be on different trajectories. I used to work in regulation. I used to have to work with quarry owners, and I had to work with ECAM because we looked after discharge to land, they looked after discharge to air. So, you know, it was all a bit, sometimes you pass each other in the night, so to speak, and throw, you know, and the complaints would come in, and it wasn't very disjointed. So, bringing in bigger unitaries. We're already a unitary, and I actually had someone on yesterday, can you explain what a unitary is? We look after everything for local government in our region. There are not two entities, and because we're a unitary, we don't have to amalgamate with anyone. We can choose to, but we don't have to. So I think that's a really important point. And maybe it's in our future, but right now we've got a lot on our plate, and we don't need the disruption of having to amalgamate. I do feel for my colleagues out there, because we've got RMA changes, three water entities to set up, a very challenging environment. We've got a cost of living crisis, plus now we've got a fuel crisis as well. So we've got enough on our plate without having to worry about that.
That was Tasman District Council Chief Executive Leonie Ray. And a link to the information forum which Leonie talked about is in the show notes. Leonie also talked about the upcoming notification for Plan Change 81 and Change 1 to the Regional Policy Statement. In the week of May 25, a series of Meet the Planners drop-in sessions were held, one of which was in Takaka, where I caught up with Golden Bay Community Board member Clarissa Brunning and asked her if she thought the sessions were worthwhile.
Yes, definitely. It was great to see the maps on the wall and being able to zero in on a few different aspects and ask topical questions about, you know, properties and get those questions answered right there and then. Golden Bay is a very unique little location. There's so many different aspects, so many little pockets and little different, you know, places that things are needed for different places and different times. And the growth here could be and probably will be quite amazing. Everyone seems to love our slice of paradise, but it's also trying to protect things that are valuable for us now and in the future as well, but also plan for that growth in the future.
Golden Bay Community Board member Clarissa Brunning speaking after the Plan Change 81 Meet the Planners drop-in session in Takaka. The last of these sessions takes place Monday 8 June in the Wakefield Village Hall, with doors open at 5:30 and remaining that way till 7 o'clock. There will be a presentation at 5:45. Now, this will cover the journey to date and will be followed by a Q&A session. And should you have any questions about your property or neighbourhood, planners will be available to talk to you in person. It was a game of two halves for summer 25-26 in Tasman, with a reasonable amount of rain across the district combining with some drier weather in the latter stages. In recent months, frequent weather has enabled us to keep the Waimea and Waiiti dams full and supplementing flows to water users that rely on them. In February, rainfall was a mixed bag, many sites receiving less than half of their average rainfall for the month, while other sites, particularly in the Rewalker and Lower Mutawika catchments, exceeded their average for the month. Crucially, there was minimal disruption to water users, with urban residents able to water their plants, fill the pool, or wash the car without restrictions of the previous years. So with the summer season at an end, Tim O'Connell sat down with Principal Scientist, Water and Special Projects, Joseph Thomas, to talk about the key takeaways for summer and what we can expect for the months ahead.
It was quite an inclement kind of a summer, where parts of the district got quite dry, particularly in the Upper Motueka, the Waiiti and the Waimea. And these were the areas that were under various stages of restrictions. Golden Bay had that quite good spasmodic rain, and with the Cobb Dam being quite topped up, it helped the whole of the Takaka River and the water systems in Takaka, and also a bit more wetter weather in the Areri catchment. These three dry areas that I've mentioned, you know, of the three, the Motupiko got the driest. And in the Waiiti, there's been a Waiiti community dam that was built way back in 2007, and that dam was able to alleviate not having to bring restrictions into the Waiiti. And in the Waimea dam again helped to support those people that have subscribed to the dam, so they did not have any restrictions. But those that didn't, they got to the stage of having a sea stake, but only lasted a very short time, about a week, before the rain came and lifted them out of the sea stake. In the Mutri, because of the clay geology, the rain, the spasmodic rain helped, because you need a long dry spell to have a compounding effect on the aquifer. So those aquifers in the Mutri did not drop to low levels as they did the previous year, which is a positive, because this deep aquifers build up over time, and because they didn't drop as low as the previous year, good rainfall over the winter will help them recharge, because they didn't quite recharge fully before summer gone past.
and some of the probably might have skipped over some residential people, especially around the Waimea area, is they didn't have, for the first time in quite a while, they haven't had to deal with any water restrictions around, you know, everyday activities such as gardening, such as watering.
You're absolutely correct, because the dam was releasing water and so was the community dam, the Waiti. None of the urban water supplies needed to be brought into restrictions. So, you know, it's a sort of, I think, at least in the Waimea Plains and Richmond and Brightwater, water restrictions are probably a thing of the past for urban and industrial users, which is, you know, a positive.
A few residents might be curious just about what lies in store for the coming months, especially with the forecast of an El Nino weather pattern coming up. What do you expect to sort of come from that for Tasman?
Well, they're predicting a very strong El Nino. It's very hard because Tasman sits right between the east and the west, and El Ninos tend to make the east of New Zealand a lot drier, like the Marlboroughs and the Canterburys and Hawke's Bays. However, from our experience, the areas this side of Takaka Hill, I mean this side between Takaka Hill and eastern Richmond and the upper Motueka, we tend to follow more of the east coast of New Zealand weather pattern. Yeah. So the past dries tend to be when we've done El Nino. This side of Takaka Hill can get quite dry, and the side over Takaka Hill going to Collingwood, they tend to, you know, be not so affected. So again, it's not exact science in terms of you know, top of the South Island, but the area between Takaka Hill and Richmond tends to follow a drier pattern during El Nino.
Talking about the rain, water and other things, Tasman District Council Principal Scientist, Water and Special Projects, Joseph Thomas. In Aotearoa, kitchen scraps and garden waste makes up a large part of household waste that we send to landfill. Close to half of all waste taken to the York Valley landfill is domestic waste, and more than 18% of that is food and green waste. In landfills, organic waste releases methane, a major greenhouse gas, so composting is a great way to keep your garden and kitchen waste out of the landfill, feed your garden, save money, and help the planet. To find out more, Darren Palmer talks composting with Prashanti Lovegrove from our Community Partnerships team.
So Prashanti, what's your role at council, and you know, how are you involved in compost?
Yeah, cool. So my name's Prashanti Lovegrove and I'm on the Community Partnerships team with Tasman District Council. My role is an Environmental Education Officer and I'm particularly passionate about composting. Before I came to work at council, I was involved in running small-scale composting projects, and I stay connected nationally with the Aotearoa Composters Network. So
cool. So it's, and we're talking more this one. We're focusing mainly on the household.
Yes,
and getting rid of your food scraps, your, well, I guess garden waste to a degree. But where do we start? Where does someone start when you want to get into composting? It's this big world of stuff.
That's right. I think where you start is the why. Why are you motivated? Why do you want to make a difference, or this behaviour change piece? And I think where I start with my corridor is with the landfill and the waste issues that we face as a community, as a society, and really the importance of minimising waste to landfill, and then also capturing and utilising those nutrients that come from our food waste.
Because it's useful for us at home, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It's a mindset, though, because I guess a lot of people go, oh, my stars, composting, where do I start? I mean, where do you start? How do you start? What's the best way to get into it?
Yeah, so the first thing you need to do is get yourself a kitchen bucket and make it right for your family, for your household. Is it something that's an open bucket on the floor, or is it a lidded bucket on the bench? And just start to separate the waste streams. Put your food scraps in one place rather than mix it with all the plastics and all the other rubbish in your household.
Because we're getting good at the the 1, 2, and 5 plastics. We've got that ingrained, and we know what should go to landfill and what should be recycled. But the food waste thing is still seems to be a little bit of unknown.
That's right. It's really up to the resident to manage the food waste. We don't have any council services in regards to food scraps collections, and we probably won't in the near future. So my role is really to empower our residents to take action for themselves. We can minimise waste in our household through separating the food scraps and composting that at home.
Okay, so we've got them separated, we've got them in our bucket. Where do we go from there? We just stick them on the garden and let it happen, or do we need to think about it?
Then we have a few different options of composting setups, one of them being worm farming, or alternatively just your traditional black plastic compost bin, quite cheap and affordable from the hardware shop. So what you really need to do for composting is you need more than just your food scraps ingredient. You need to source another ingredient, which we refer to as brown materials. Brown materials are traditionally, they're made up of carbon-rich materials like wood, mulch, sticks and twigs, brown leaves, those kinds of things. And so we really need to layer our food scraps, which we can call our green materials, with our brown materials on top of that. It's really important that when we put our food scraps in our compost bin, that we always cover our food scraps with the brown materials on top.
Any food scraps that you can't put in the bin, or can just chuck it in?
Yeah, so I dive deeply into this in my compost workshops. I really like to dispel the myth of not composting meats and oils and fats. However, there are reasons why we, as a community, we have this messaging. Mostly when we compost meats and oils and fats, it's because it creates a smell, and that smell can attract rodents to our compost bins. And so many people don't want the rodents, they don't want the smell, and so those are the reasons why. It's not because we can't compost meat and dairy or bread even, it's just that the composting process creates some smell. It also creates some warmth, and that is where the rodents like to come in. So even if we're not composting meat and dairy, we still might have rodents in our vegetable compost because it's a warm place to sleep in the nighttime.
How long does the process take? I mean, and when can I start dumping it on my garden as food for my plants?
Yeah, so a home compost setup will take a long time. A home will be feeding the compost bin a little bit at a time. And so through that a little bit at a time, it will take a long time for the compost to be complete. So you really, it depends what your goal is. If your goal is to minimise waste from landfill, then that's great. It can take as long as it wants. If your goal is to produce compost quickly, then we need to be gathering our ingredients and building our compost bin full all in one day.
So I guess a smaller operation there is probably more beneficial if you want it here and now, rather than the big bin that you'll have in 12 months' time.
Yeah, compost can take at least 12 months, if not longer, if you're just doing it at home, adding a little bit at a time. Yeah, and turning the bin is also very important. The black compost bins are slightly angled, so if you want your compost to happen more quickly, then you lift the bin up, put it next door, and shovel that over so that you're adding air. The air actually heats up, supports that decomposition process.
Yeah.
And there's a fourth ingredient that I haven't mentioned. So far we're composting needs green materials, brown materials, air, and the fourth ingredient is water. Water is life.
Yep.
And water is a very important part of composting. There is actually a fifth ingredient that's not really a physical thing, but rather this fifth element of time, and that if you add your four ingredients together, you need time to make the composting happen.
Quite a recipe, isn't it?
It is.
Like baking a cake.
Yeah.
But the outcome is great, and you've got your compost. Can you put it anywhere in your garden? I guess it benefits everything because it's nature going back to nature and –
That's right.
Yeah.
It's pretty much it's organic matter or vermicast if it's from a worm farm. And that organic matter is full of nutrients, full of beneficial microorganisms that help to feed your plants and give them the nutrition that plants need to grow. So, yes, you can put it on the top of your vegetable garden. You can put it around your fruit trees. I think one thing we dive into in the workshop is around this question of weed seeds.
Mm.
And our cold compost that we're doing at home doesn't kill the weed seeds. So we need to be cautious of the weeds that we're continuing to allow to thrive. So it wouldn't really be the best product to pot up plants to use for growing seedlings and things like that because of the weed seeds.
But it's a good base.
Great base.
For mixing in what else you've got. There are other systems too. I mean, these are other composting systems. We've got worm farms.
Yes.
Bokashi.
Yep.
What else? I mean, Bokashi seems to be, well, we've done it and it's quite simple, straightforward,
yeah,
and a relatively rapid result.
Yes, yeah, so Bokashi composting is not actually composting as such.
Right.
It's more of a pre-fermentation process. It's a really awesome thing to do to your food scraps, to ferment them with beneficial anaerobic microorganisms before they go in the compost bin. So we can ferment our food scraps through Bokashi, but we still add it to the compost bin. We still need to cover it with the brown materials after.
To work the system.
Yes.
And worm farms. My kids, like when they were little, I mean, they're way bigger now, but the worm farm was fascinating until we went on holiday one year and they migrated because they got dry, they dried out.
That's right.
But the worm farm with the worm casts and the,
yep,
the worm wheeze.
Yes,
that's handy.
Worm farms need a lot more attention, mostly because they're a fully artificial environment, so they're not attached to the ground. Once we create this artificial environment, our human intervention is required a bit more. So worms don't need as much brown materials, but they do need to be fed a little bit often. And that's where sometimes worm farms die because we forget about feeding them often. But my top tip for worm farming is to put some horse manure into your worm farm, and that will see your worm farm through. If you go on holiday, the worms will just take their time munching through all of that horse manure.
I guess there's moisture in there too for them.
Yep, and yeah, a lot of fibre and grass, green things that the horses have just eaten.
So in summary, go for it. I mean, where do I start? We grab the bucket, get the food scraps, put them aside, find a place outside to get a compost bin,
yep,
going, and just, yeah, advice. That's the thing. If people get stuck and think, oh, man, it's too much for us, where can you turn?
Yeah. Look, there's always going to be – there's so many different ways to compost. You can do in-ground worm farming. There's the tumblers. If you're afraid of rodents, there's different ways you can do composting to keep rodents out. I would really encourage you to start by separating your food scraps from your general rubbish bin in the kitchen and just get going. Yeah, our council offers a $20 discount if you wanted to go to the hardware shop to purchase a setup, then we can give you a $20 discount on that.
That's handy. And our website has advice too, is it?
Yes.
That's TDC, tasman.government.nz for anyone who's interested. Hey, Prashanti, thank you for that. That,
yeah,
was awesome.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Prashanti Lovegrove from our community partnerships team, talking composting with Darren Palmer. Links to websites and events mentioned in this podcast are in the show notes. And music credits, Mr. Washington and Contra. I'm Sean Bullock, and this show is a production of the Tasman District Council.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast by Fresh FM, with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.co.nz for our contact details.